You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Yesterday, Australia recognised the state of Palestine.
This death and destruction horrifies all of us. It must end.
Does nothing to end this conflict and bring this war to a close.
I hate my opponent, and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry.
What happens when you yield? The bully comes after you again.
You know, no one silences us.
Welcome back to World News Weekly. I'm Claudia Farhart in Jakarta. We've got a very special edition of the pod coming up for you today. Joining me this week, all the way from New York, are our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson, our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, and correspondent, Prue Lawan. Hello, guys.
Great to be here, Claudia.
Hello, everyone from Jakarta to other parts of New York.
And hello, everyone, as well.
All right, now that we've got all of that out of the way, this week is actually all about the UN General Assembly, where 10 Western nations, including Australia, are recognising the state of Palestine. We're also going to be chatting about MAGA's widening war on the left this week, the president's paracetamol claims that have stunned scientists, and more moves from his administration to crack down on immigration. Okay, let's get into it.
I stand before you today beneath the emblem of the United Nations to confirm the historic decision of the British government to recognise the state of Palestine.
We offer our full partnership in building the promise of a peaceful future.
We must choose a different path. We must break this cycle of violence and build something better.
Anna, Anthony Albanese was in that mix. What's it been like there this week?
This was a huge decision from the Australian government, and it was front run. We have known since August that this was the Prime Minister's plan. He did a big press conference at the time and laid out all the reasoning. In some ways, it took other nations like the UK and France to flag they were doing the same thing and to give Australia a little bit of cover to be able to go out with these sort of like-minded Western nations and take this position. But it wasn't without the potential for political pain for Anthony Albanese, because for a very long time there has been this sense between the two major parties that they have a bipartisan approach, that it's a two-state solution that they're committed to, and that statehood comes after peace. And Penny Wong then laid the groundwork more than a year ago by saying there is a discussion happening internationally about whether statehood can happen on the pathway to peace. But there's been a lot of really strong criticism, you know, understandably from the Israeli embassy and from the Israeli government. They've ramped up the pressure on the Prime Minister, from the opposition as well, saying this just rewards Hamas. I mean, we're hearing some of the same arguments in different parts of the world. And then at the last minute, we had the addition of about 25 Republicans writing to the Prime Minister an open letter piling on more pressure just ahead of this week to say, you know, things could be more difficult for you with your closest security ally, the US, if you take this path. What about the AUKUS deal? They questioned other things that we've done recently with the US and whether or not the Trump administration would honour them if Australia split with the US on something that for a long time they've sort of held that sense of common lockstep. So it was a big deal that the Albanese government did that, a legacy moment for the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. But it's also worth noting that it's in the Labor Party platform. The base of the Labor Party watching what's happening in Gaza was increasingly pressuring the government to take stronger action, to make good on that party platform. And that's what Anthony Albanese quite strongly and quite proudly has done this week, really making a virtue in his own kind of worldview of saying, I'm going to step apart from the US and we're going to follow our own sort of sovereign national decision-making process here.
And it wasn't just Australia making that move to recognise the state of Palestine this week. Anthony Albanese was one of 10 Western leaders. We now have more than 157 UN member states, I believe, recognising the state of Palestine. That's something like 80% of the UN's membership. Ben, what's it been like there, this international move for recognition?
Yeah, this was obviously very carefully coordinated, and it was being driven mainly by France and by Saudi Arabia. And Emmanuel Macron had been speaking for a couple of months, making the case for this to happen. And he said it pretty bluntly in his speech at the General Assembly today. He essentially said, look, now is the time. If we leave this until next year, there might not be a Palestinian state left to recognise. There is acceptance among these leaders. We heard it from Prime Minister Albanese. We've heard it from Keir Starmer, Mark Carney of Canada, saying, look, we understand this is largely symbolic. It's not going to end the humanitarian crisis. It's not going to stop the expansion of settlements. But it is a statement by much of the world, many of Israel's traditional allies, that things have gone too far. It is a time for peace. At the same time, you have to look at the Israeli response. And I spoke to Israel's ambassador to the UN yesterday, and he said, look, we think these countries are just doing this for domestic political reasons, because people have been marching in the streets. Some of these parties rely on sort of more left-leaning anti-Israel votes to get elected. And all Israel really cares about is the support of the United States. And Donald Trump has made it very clear he is essentially going to continue allowing Benjamin Netanyahu to do as he wants.
Yeah, and on Donald Trump, there's still a lot more to talk about in regards to Palestinian recognition, but we just have heard his address to the General Assembly. It seems like he took aim at everything from the entire Western world to the UN's renovations in that one. Here's some of what he had to say.
It's time to end the failed experiment of open borders. You have to end it now. See, I can tell you, I'm really good at this stuff. Your countries are going to hell. Whatever the hell happens, there's climate change. It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion. I ended 7 wars, dealt with the leaders of each and every one of these countries, and never even received a phone call from the United Nations offering to help. That being the case, what is the purpose of the United Nations?
You know, it's funny, during his first term, his first address to the United Nations General Assembly, leaders were laughing at him when he was bragging about doing more than any administration in American history. This time, no one was laughing. He did make a couple of jokes early on that got a giggle. But for the rest of it, other leaders, diplomats were sort of squirming in their seats, looking a bit uncomfortable. And it's easy to see why. I mean, he was having a go at Europe, saying, you know, unlimited migration meant their countries were going to hell. He called the science of climate change the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world. And he even criticised the UN really directly itself, saying, look, I'm the one doing all the peacemaking. All they do here is write letters and then never follow up, which in a way shows a misunderstanding of what the UN is actually capable of doing. So it's clear what Donald Trump thinks of the UN because he said it at the UN. At the same time, he can change his mind like that. And he did to a degree. He made this hugely fiery speech attacking the UN. 5 minutes later, he was meeting with the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, and saying, oh, America's behind the UN 100%. We think it could be a good organisation. It just needs to change. So as always with Trump, you know, it's very hard to take what he says in 1 minute seriously, given that he often changes his mind very soon after. The interesting thing to note, though, is despite this speech where he was attacking a lot of the countries of leaders who were sitting there, I haven't heard a single leader actually criticising what Donald Trump said. Leaders now know that the best way to deal with Donald Trump, to get in his good graces, is either to flatter him or at the very least not criticise him. And that seems to be what's happening here at the moment.
Let's do a case in point of that very briefly, just to explain, you know, exactly how that is working. So the Prime Minister then did a media event this afternoon after the Trump speech, and we had, Donald Trump talking about climate change being a con and a sham, and that everyone being hoodwinked, and that what he called windmills were pathetic. Like, it was a pretty extensive takedown of the science of climate change and net zero ambitions across the world and the Paris Agreement. The Prime Minister was asked about his response to that and, you know, was he concerned about that language? And he said that the President has his views and he can express them. And then there was a very clear full stop. despite the fact that these are two leaders that couldn't disagree more on that policy area, the Prime Minister is very carefully walking this line of not wanting to delve into these questions. Twiggy Forrest, however, from Fortescue, the billionaire, he didn't hold back at all. He sometimes, I think, likes to think of himself as somewhat of another kind of version of a leader of the Australian nation. And he really hit back very strongly at Donald Trump and said that he wasn't really living in reality if he was making these claims. But, yeah, Ben, you're absolutely right. Straight away, leaders were being very keen to tread softly.
And it was really interesting, too, after this speech, we saw Donald Trump doing the rounds, all sorts of bilateral meetings, none with Mr. Albanese today, but we'll get onto that later. But he did have a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky. Now, you remember earlier this year, there was that disastrous meeting in the Oval Office that turned into a screaming match. The Ukrainian president has done a pretty good job at sort of working his way back into Trump's good graces. And today it seemed to pay off. Donald Trump complimented the Ukrainian president on how he's running the country at the moment, complimented the Ukrainian military on being able to hold their ground. And he went a little bit further than many had been expecting. A reporter asked Donald Trump, "Do you think NATO countries should shoot down Russian aircraft if they enter their airspace?" And Donald Trump said, "Yes, I do." And Volodymyr Zelensky, you don't see him smile all that often these days. He had a big smile on his face when he heard that. And he was even happier a little later on when the president posted on Truth Social, "I think Ukraine is in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form. Putin and Russia are in big economic trouble, and this is the time for Ukraine to act." Zelensky said, "Look, this is a big shift," the Trump posted. "Is a big shift in his position." Of course, we know with Donald Trump, he often just sides with the last person he spoke to. Vladimir Putin could ring tonight and he'll change his mind completely. So Kyiv is welcoming this change in tone from the American president. However, they know that things could change very quickly.
And Prue, how's his speech gone down in the US? How's US media and people across the country responding to it so far?
I think that the speech once again shows why his base absolutely loves him, because he comes across as authentic as opposed to a politician. There were some problems with the auto cue, with the prompter at one point, and he handles it like a regular person would, as opposed to a wooden politician. He says, "I'm really good at this stuff." We would all think of him as being unfiltered and perhaps not a professional speaker. That's why his base absolutely love him. That's why the Democrats still have no mechanism yet for how to deal with him, because it might seem to us that he's just saying what's in the top of his head, but he comes across to his base as someone who's authentic, who's not manicured, who's not mannered, who's not manipulative. And they love that. So the press that's based here in New York has not yet found a way of handling events like this. They are fact-checking every 30 seconds, but they don't get the spirit of it, which is that his base absolutely love it. And as Ben was saying, he says outrageous things. Your country's going to hell. You could fact-check what he's saying about climate change, and he's frequently wrong. The fact-checking doesn't actually take him down, because his base loves the fact that he doesn't feel like a politician. Of course, everyone on the left absolutely can't stand him, but they're kind of wringing their hands at the fact that they don't know what to do yet. They don't have a leader. And because this country isn't a parliamentary system, there isn't an opposition leader, but they sure as heck need to find one, and they haven't yet.
All right, I want to get us back to the two-state solution conference now, guys. There's already been some blowback to this across the US and in Israel. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas wasn't there to witness this moment because the US denied him and his delegation visas. We knew Anthony Albanese was hoping to get a meeting with Donald Trump this week. He was left off the schedule, although we're now hearing that might happen next month now. And we're now starting to see Israel engaging with the conservative opposition in a bunch of these countries instead of the actual governments. They've had calls with Susan Lee in Australia this week, as well as Nigel Farage in the UK. So what do you guys make of all of that? Is this sort of becoming Israel and the US against the world now?
I certainly think this is the kind of isolating tactic that Australia, the UK and Canada in particular have discussed with France about, if there's no way that we can change the passage of how the Netanyahu government is dealing with its ambitions and its offensive in Gaza, That is through the usual diplomatic channels of calling in ambassadors, of, you know, making public statements. They were writing letters for a while, appealing for change. The decision was made, we have to move in a coordinated way to do something quite dramatic to make Israel and the United States feel like they are isolated and the rest of the world is on a different path to them. And this is the next stage of that. There is definitely discussion about further sanctions to come that could be really, really wide-ranging, that could be across the whole Netanyahu government to try and keep ramping up the pressure. It doesn't end with recognition of statehood, but that's certainly a part of it. And it was incendiary for the Prime Minister to stay in that conference, that he thinks that the Palestinian people should have hope for a home of their own. Incendiary to Israel and to the US and to the opposition in Australia. They happily engage with the Israeli ambassador frequently and with the foreign minister of Israel as well. Though it's interesting that in the last day or so, the opposition leader's office has been very keen to make clear that it was the Israeli foreign minister that contacted Susan Lee and not the other way around.
I just want to bring up Donald Trump's reaction to all this. So in his General Assembly speech today, he briefly mentioned it. He talked about it again when he was sitting down with Emmanuel Macron, and he said, look, you know, I don't agree with recognition of an independent Palestinian state. He said he thinks that he's a prize for Hamas and you can't do that because of October 7. Emmanuel Macron said, look, no one forgets the 7th of October, but this does need to end. Donald Trump's reaction to all of these countries, close allies, friends, doing something he doesn't want them to do, has actually been quite muted. I mean, he hasn't been using sort of the usual hyperbole he would use. Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, you know, was the vitriol, really, towards Keir Starmer, Mark Carney and Anthony Albanese. We haven't heard the same from Donald Trump, which is really interesting. And I do wonder if behind the scenes there's been some sort of discussion about this, you know, that he's agreed not to publicly be too critical over this. And could that perhaps reflect the private frustration that he is said to have with Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government at the moment? Maybe it does help Donald Trump a little bit, having some of these other countries coming out, putting pressure on Israel to end the war, even if he can't say that publicly.
And it is worth noting that the Prime Minister, when he couldn't get the meeting, it appeared, with Donald Trump this week, and when, you know, it was a will they, won't they, it looks like people have flown here, including the Prime Minister, and prepared for a meeting with Donald Trump, and he's off the schedule, it's not going to happen. There was some discussion at that point and suggestion maybe this is a response to the fact that Australia has gone ahead with the recognition of Palestinian statehood, that this is part of the approach Donald Trump is taking to sort of shun and snub a leader that takes this path. But obviously that isn't the case, because Donald Trump's just been in the UK. He's engaging with other leaders as well. And Claudia, I can also confirm to you that, yes, the Prime Minister will be having a meeting with Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. next month, and that in the last couple of hours, the pair have spoken in person for the first time. So the idea that, in fact, Donald Trump was holding this meeting over the Prime Minister over Palestinian statehood doesn't appear to be founded in what we've seen unfold over the last day or so. And the Prime Minister, I think, throughout this has been quietly confident that statehood was not going to break the relationship.
We saw something similar. I mean, it was just sort of incidental, almost accidental, between the presidents of the United States and Brazil. The vitriol that's been flowing both ways between the two countries, between the two leaders, in terms of what's happening with Bolsonaro in Brazil, has been quite acute. And then Trump shares in his speech at the United Nations that they'd bumped into each other and given each other a hug, and that their little encounter lasted for about 39 seconds, and that then he shared with everyone that they were going to be meeting next week. So it's a similar thing, that the public statements might be quite dire, but then he turns around and it's not peace and love, but it's certainly a meeting.
Okay, I also want to chat to you guys about what this all means on the ground in Gaza, in Israel, and in the West Bank. As we're seeing statehood recognized, as we're seeing this summit on achieving a two-state solution, we're also seeing more moves on the ground that seem to be aimed at preventing one. This week, we've had Israel's far-right National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, saying he'll be submitting a proposal to the Knesset in the coming days to annex the West Bank in its entirety. We also saw far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich describe Gaza as a real estate bonanza, saying, quote, we've done the demolition phase, now we need to rebuild. So does all of that give you guys the feeling that even though we have these states formalizing their recognition this week, that the chances of reaching an actual two-state solution are just getting more remote?
I'd say that the chance of a two-state solution is about the same this week as it was 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, in that it's still a very, very far-off distant dream. For many, it will be really interesting to see what Benjamin Netanyahu does after his meeting with Donald Trump at the White House in a few days' time. In response to the Australia, Britain, France announcing recognition of an independent Palestinian state, he said, look, there will be a response. You'll hear it after my trip to the United States. Now, a lot of people have taken that to mean that he essentially needs Donald Trump's permission to do whatever that is going to be next. The most logical thing for him would be further annexations in the West Bank. It's just a case of how far he would go with that, because there are sort of separate domestic political pressures back home, his far-right coalition, the opposition, so on. So that seems the most likely result. But all of these countries pushing for recognition have said, look, yes, this is largely symbolic. It's not going to stop the war. It's not going to solve this problem, but it is simply the moral imperative at the moment. It's the right thing for them to do.
And Prue, how's this landing in the US? I mean, these are all countries that until recently Washington sort of counted as its best friends. Is there a feeling that this could cause any sort of problems for the Trump administration?
I guess you have to ask yourself, Claudia, when was the last time you saw major street demonstrations, major protests in a number of American cities about this issue? It's a while, isn't it? I mean, if you think about Australia, we've seen protests in Sydney, Melbourne, other cities. You're seeing protests in Europe. When was the last time you saw a major protest in New York or Los Angeles or Chicago? I think that's your answer, because I haven't.
That man, that young man, I forgive him.
I hate my opponent, and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry.
The wife of the late Charlie Kirk, Erica, and Donald Trump there with two very different takes on life at the conservative activist's memorial service on Sunday. Went on for 5 hours. At times it resembled a MAGA rally. The president's speech seemed to be part tribute, part rallying cry against what he calls the radical left. Also this week, we saw the president sign an executive order designating the Antifa movement, which isn't actually any one group, a terrorist organization. Another late night talk show host was suspended. Jimmy Kimmel stood down for about a week over comments he made about Charlie Kirk's killing. And now the president's suing the New York Times for $15 billion, essentially over unfavorable coverage. So once again, we're seeing a lot of concerns being raised over freedom of speech in the US. But I want to start with the Charlie Kirk memorial service. Prue, do you think we saw some hints in that as to where the Trump administration and their support base might be heading?
Obviously, it was an excruciatingly difficult moment for many people. We're talking about the politics of it, but a man had been shot dead and there's his wife there. And as you said, there were two very different points of view, worldviews that were encapsulated in that moment. There's Erica saying, I forgive him. The man as a result of which her kids don't have a father anymore. And then you have the president of the United States saying, I'm sorry, I don't feel that way. I hate my enemies. And what's interesting is not that they have different worldviews. It's that somehow Trump has the support of people who inherently disagree with him. The Christians who are there, who are espousing forgiving someone who's done the most heinous thing, he has them in the palm of his hand. So my interest is, going into the next election, whoever the Republican candidate may be, J.D. Vance or whoever, all of the people on Team Trump, whether it's Stephen Miller or J.D. Vance, are talking about the same Christian values. And Trump is saying in his speeches, including, by the way, at the UN, Christianity, I'm sure, Ben, you remember this moment when he says the most persecuted religion is Christianity. Somehow Trump, whilst actually explicitly saying to Erica, I disagree with you about forgiveness, has the support of all these people. I don't know where it goes in terms of civil unrest in this country, but the fact that Trump is able to bring these people along with him is politically fascinating.
And Prue, it's interesting you mentioned that UN speech too, because he was talking about, you know, you hear quite a lot from Republicans here, you know, let's protect religious liberty, going on to talk about Christianity, but there was sort of like a cultural dynamic to what he was saying there as well. You know, the criticism of Europe, the sense that, you know, the Judeo-Christian heritage is being threatened by people from other parts of the world. It's that sort of merging of conservative politics and Christianity. I heard one American journalist today at the General Assembly chatting about this, and they were saying if they had to put their money on it, they think the next Republican ticket will be J.D. Vance for president and Erica Kirk for vice president. Is that crazy?
We have a new benchmark for crazy, don't we, Ben? I mean, nothing is predictable anymore. I don't know about you, but I wake up every day and just check, you know, are we still intact? And then, of course, just waking up like once a day, that doesn't do it. I mean, we've all talked about this. The news cycle is insane. So I think you're a brave person, or that was a brave person who thought that we can, you know, choose the ticket 3.5 years out. I have no idea.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's been really interesting to see in Australia is how much Charlie Kirk has resonated with particularly a number of members of the federal opposition, Andrew Hastie and Michaelia Cash. Senator Cash was moved to tears on camera during her discussion about him during the week. Andrew Hastie posted a very moving sort of tribute. They not only seem to see him as somebody who they want to mourn for, but someone who they saw as an international sort of guiding light for their politics, and the way he did politics and the way he engaged was something that they were really looking to for their own style of engagement and trying to win back voters in coming elections. So it certainly has resonated here, and with a particular group of politicians, it's been really noticeable.
So taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good.
Okay, so in between all of that, Donald Trump and his health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also found time to wage war on paracetamol this week, known as Tylenol in the States. The pair gathered the press in the Oval Office and made unproven claims that the pain relief medication has been linked to autism in unborn babies. Anna, how did this one land over there?
Well, it was one of those water cooler announcements, because it's the kind of thing that particularly, you know, every family, every pregnant woman, every bloke who's gone through it with their partner, or woman who's gone through it with their partner, every family thinks that it's just such a normal thing to do, to take, you know, Tylenol or, you know, some other basic pain relief medication during pregnancy. And it is a painful time for many women. So the idea that this would now be claimed to be linked to autism was really kind of extraordinary. It was very worrying for a lot of people. The Prime Minister was actually asked about it today while he's over here. Another attempt, I think, by the Australian press to kind of lay in front of our government something which would normally be probably quite robustly criticised. And the Prime Minister's response was to say, well, we have our own guidelines in Australia for how we deal with medication, full stop. But, you know, in terms of the broader ramifications and how this kind of a story can really cause fear and guilt for mothers, it has had a big impact.
And there were more Trump pronouncements raising eyebrows around the world this week, Ben. His demand to get the Bagram Air Base back.
Yeah, this one came as quite a surprise. I was at Chequers and he was chatting away at the press conference with Keir Starmer and just said, here's a little bit of news for you. And then announced essentially that the US government is in talks with the Taliban to try and take this airbase in Afghanistan back. Now, it is important, was important to the Americans because it's quite close to the borders of China and Pakistan. And Trump himself even said it's not far away from where China manufactures its nuclear weapons. I'm sure all the CIA folks were thrilled that he said that out loud in the press conference. Some obvious questions here would be, you know, what would it cost to get it back? And also, how would you secure it? This is an airbase in a country that is now controlled by the Taliban, with the Pakistani army not far away, the Chinese military not far away. Is he really suggesting that you would take this airbase back and then send American troops back into Afghanistan after the absolute disaster we saw when the American troops left Afghanistan? But apparently these talks are actually happening in the background and the Taliban government has been receptive, although whether this actually happens, it seems unlikely, but with Donald Trump all the time, anything is possible.
Because so many things happen in this administration all the time, it's easy to forget that it's only a couple of months ago that he wanted Canada. He also wanted Greenland. So, and those things seem to be quiet at the moment. So at the moment, it's Bagram. I don't know what it will be in a couple of months' time. This issue may completely go away, or maybe it's the first one out of those trio that he actually manages to get. We don't know.
So those were some of the big headline-grabbing things we saw come out of the States this week, but there's also been a few others flying under the radar, Prue.
Claudia, what interests me is sometimes the quiet things, because sometimes they're more sustained and there's so much fireworks going on that we don't get time to look at them. The Department of Agriculture has or had something called the Household Food Insecurity Report. Now, it's just what it says. It measures hunger in the United States. It has for the last 30 years. It's the Department of Agriculture's own report. What we know from 2023 is that 47 million Americans were food insecure. And unsurprisingly, that insecurity was more pronounced in Black and Latino households. Well, this report is no longer going to exist. One more will come out because it's already been prepared for 2024, and then that's it. It's been cancelled by the Trump administration. And this is the reason why. They said it was, quote, rife with inaccuracies, wrong metrics, zero accountability. These redundant, costly, politicised and extraneous studies do nothing more than fearmonger. Now, the curious thing about that is, number one, it's the government casting doubt on the government, which is a thing we've seen with the Trump administration. But the timing is also curious. Of course, Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, he signed it on July 4, cut money for food stamps so that the bipartisan congressional office has already determined that about 2.5 million Americans will no longer be getting food stamps. So at a time when money to help people no longer be hungry has dwindled, we're no longer going to be studying whether the people are actually hungry. That's something that has been studied for the past 30 years, won't be anymore. I find that interesting.
And what about this 70-year-old organization that makes sure women are more involved in the military? What's Pete Hegseth done with that?
The Department of War, I don't know about you, Ben, but I'm still getting used to saying the Department of War. In any event, we know that the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, has decided to terminate what's called the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services. And Claudia, you're absolutely right. 74 years it's been going. It was founded in 1951. The website tells you that 1,100 of its recommendations about women and how they should be treated in the services have been taken on board. That's about 94% of full or partial adoption of recommendations. In other words, it was set up 75 years ago. It's been tootling along, doing its business, and it stopped because of this is what the Department of War press secretary said, quote, "The committee is focused on advancing a divisive feminist agenda that hurts combat readiness. And so it just stops. So it's totally fascinating to me. These are the quiet stories, but they're not undoing what was done by Obama or Biden. This is an administration that looks a long way back and says, what you started in 1951, we're going to stop it.
Okay, Ben, Anna Prue, while we've still got you on the line, something else that came out of the UN General Assembly this week, French President Emmanuel Macron getting caught out by Donald Trump's motorcade.
How are you? Guess what? I'm waiting in the street because everything is frozen for you.
French President not sounding too happy there, Anna.
And, you know, it triggered another quite... Well, I don't know if it's a humorous moment, but an awkward moment for the Prime Minister because, you know, seeing President Macron just casually picking up the phone and making a phone call to Donald Trump is exactly what the Australian Prime Minister says he could never possibly do because such things are always arranged by other people, you know, diplomats and sort of people in the background who set a time and then the Prime Minister would take the call that has been arranged. And this casual engagement of another world leader has made things a bit tricky for him because a number of times the Prime Minister has been asked why he hasn't just picked up the phone to Donald Trump to get security on various issues and he said it doesn't work like that. Well, today he was asked again, Macron can pick up the phone, why can't you? And he said he was joking in the election campaign when he said he didn't have Donald Trump's direct number. So the plot thickens, but we definitely know that our Prime Minister so far has not been this casual with his relationship with the US president.
Macron has massive problems at home in terms of government. Ben, you've been reporting on it. And I don't know how this plays, but if he had played it the way maybe an Australian politician would be, who was actually on the street, it's actually political gold. If you could be relaxed in that situation, you would come across as just every man, cool in all circumstances. Macron seemed to me a little bit indignant. I'm not sure if he actually comes out of this well or not, but politically it was an opportunity to go, well, I've been treated badly, but, you know, I'm left here on the streets of New York, as many of us have been, and not being able to get through the traffic. By the way, that's the one thing that politicians and who come to this event and New Yorkers have in common. We all hate it. We all just want it to be over. It makes the city a living nightmare. And just for that one moment, Macron was like the rest of us, just get me out of here.
And I love it. In a sense, because the only politician really who gets the full like motorcade escort in is the President of the United States. Everyone else, I mean, Emmanuel Macron is an important dude and he's walking 30 minutes to get back to the French embassy. I was waiting at a checkpoint yesterday and I saw a guy walking towards me. I'm like, he looks really familiar. And then walked past and I realised he had a Finland flag on his lapel and it was the President of Finland. And he'd been to the same Dunkin' Donuts I'd been to get a coffee that morning. They're just like the rest of us. I had one wonderful incident today, though. I was lining up to go into the General Assembly Hall to see Donald Trump speak and walking in my direction, this is so nerdy, was the EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas. And I smiled at her because I think she's a very capable politician and she smiled back and gave me a little head nod. And for geopolitics nerds, that is like having, I don't know, like your favourite AFL player giving you a high five, you know? I felt I was part of a little special club just for a moment.
What a glorious note to end this very special edition of World News Weekly on. Thank you so much to our Chief International Correspondent, Ben Lewis, Chief Political Correspondent, Anna Henderson, and Correspondent Prue Lewin for joining us today all the way from New York.
Thank you, Claudia. It's been a joy.
Thanks, Claudia.
I didn't enjoy it that much.
All right, off to bed, you lot.